All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is Thursday, March 4th and 12:40, and we're here for Chem 12 lecture. And we are going to finish up today. We're going to finish up chapter 14 and even start a review for the exam. I think that's the goal for what we want to do today. So we've just got a little bit left in chapter 14 when we're looking at the ethers and epoxides component. And like we said, most of that chapter anyway in the ethers and epoxides that we're looking at is reviewed. So there's not a whole lot of new material to cover. Everything is sort of filling in the little bits of gaps here, making sure that we're all on the same page. So let me go ahead, start a screen share, and we'll finish out this chapter real quick. Let's see, I think we've only got a couple of pages left in terms of my notes. Screen share, iPad. All right. So we left off, we did the Crown ethers, we did the Williamson ether synthesis. What we didn't do was oxymercuration, demercuration to make ethers. That's kind of where we left off. This is the last little component in ether synthesis. Let me get the chat up too so that I can see that. That is helpful to have in place. Okay, so usually what we say is let's see, chapter 14, ether still. We usually say oxymercuration, demercuration. This is alkoxy mercuration. And then demercuration. And it's really nothing new here. It's very similar to what we were doing before. We simply take something that we don't want to shift. We treat it with mercury acetate. And then we treat it with an alcohol instead of water and sodium borohydride to end with. And the mechanism and the way it works is exactly as we would expect. The mercury, which has the two acetate groups on it, is attacked by the double bond. The mercury reattacks the double bond, kicks out one of the acetates, goes into the cyclic mercurium ion. The cyclic mercurium ion is asymmetrical. It has a partial positive on the mercury and a partial positive on the more stable position of the three-membered ring system. The alcohol then does a nucleophilic attack, opening that up in sort of a SN2 type mechanism. Mercury is attached. The group here is attached. And then we have a deprotonation step that occurs. This deprotonation step is not shown what base is functioning. They may add a base to this in order to make it function properly, but there is some sort of deprotonation step that occurs. And so now what we've made is we've made the ether, and the last step is to remove the mercury. And so that's done with the sodium borohydride, the H minus. That's the second step that comes in and knocks that group out. And we wind up with an ether. And it places the ether without carbocation shifts. No hydride shifts, no alkyl group shifts. And so the alkoxy mercuration demercuration is just another way of making an ether that that we hadn't really thought about using an alcohol, but makes total sense in the way that we used water to make alcohols before. If we use an alcohol in place of water, then we'll wind up with an ether instead of a hydroxy group. So that's one more way that gives us the Williamson ether synthesis, and that gives us alkoxy mercuration demercuration as a type of ether synthesis as well. So those are the two big ways that we make ethers, either the Williamson or the alkoxy mercuration demercuration. And then in reacting ethers, reactions of ethers, the only reactions that ethers really undergo are cleavages, are breaking apart. So here what we do is we take an ether and we treat it with strong acid and heat. That was supposed to be HX and heat. And in terms of the way that this works, this also works in exactly the way that we would expect it to. The first step is just the protonation of the oxygen, which creates a good leaving group. Once we create that good leaving group, the next step can be either, either an SN1 or an SN2 step. Depends on what the substrate is. Knocking the group out. This makes RX and an alcohol. Because we're using strong acid and heat, the alcohol continues to react, being protonated. That makes for a good leaving group, which can either leave via SN1 or SN2 routes. This time I'll do it as an SN1 route just to show. And then the halogen comes in and attacks that. And so what we end up with is we end up with RX and R prime X, and we end up with water as our leaving group. And so it just completely tears it apart via SN1 and SN2 reactions. Not super useful. It's not a reaction that we're generally trying to do. It's not synthetically useful to take and break apart ethers this way. It just happens that if you happen to have an ether in your reaction and you are trying to do something with strong acid and heating it, you run the risk of tearing apart the ether. And so that's something to be aware of, but not a synthetically really useful reaction. Okay, and so those are the two big things that I wanted to cover within the ethers that finish out the ether section. And then beyond that, we start to go into the epoxides. And there's a little bit more in the epoxides to cover than what we've done before. So epoxides are also called oxiranes. Two names for the same functional group. An oxirane is an epoxide. And we generally don't do the nomenclature of epoxide. So I'm going to skip that part in the interest of saving a little bit of time. And here's my take on nomenclature too, for what it's worth. These days, with computers the way that they are, and computer programs the way that they are, you can take any number of organic drawing software, draw in the molecule that you want, and then the software will name the molecule instantly. If you break a bond or change a functional group, the name updates simultaneously as you're changing the functional groups. You can give the software the name and it instantly draws the molecule for you. Because of the systematic nature of the nomenclature, software is really, really good at doing it. And so if we need to name something big or name something crazy, we just go to ChemDraw. We punch it into ChemDraw and ChemDraw punches out the name. I want you still to be able to name more simple things. And I want you to be able to do stereocenters. This morning's lab was a good example. The afternoon, we'll get a chance to do that in the afternoon too. I want you to be able to name more simple molecules and even some complications in terms of being able to do stereochemistry, E versus Z, R and S, those types of things. But when it gets to big molecules and functional groups that we don't use all the time, like epoxides or oxiranes, then we use software to name it. And so that's my little spiel on that. So I'm not going to go into the epoxide nomenclature. Let's look instead just at the chemistry. Preparation of epoxides. We already know this. MCPBA is one of the best reagents for making an epoxide. It's a sin addition, has to be, in the way that the oxygen comes from one face. So you cannot get one bond going back and one bond going forward. Those just don't look right to me. They have to be on the same face in order for it to be an epoxide. So that's the way that they are generally created. We can see that if we take a substrate that is trans, and we do MCPBA, that because of the sin addition, one way to draw it is to draw it this way with one group coming forward and one group going back. We could draw the hydrogens in there to make it a little bit more clear. If you do a cis, then when you do MCPBA, it controls your stereochemistry, such that both groups are going forward now. And so we have a trans epoxide. We have a cis epoxide in the way that it works. So that part we knew. And I think it's also fair to say that the epoxide can come from the top or bottom. And because it can come from the top or bottom, it's also true that we would get the mirror image of these. So we can get the mirror image of those guys as well. And the same for the bottom one. Now the bottom one, because of symmetry, is meso. But we can still draw it. Everybody understanding what I mean by the epoxide coming from the top or bottom? Is that making sense? Okay, because these guys are flat, planar. Trigonal planar, and because they're trigonal planar, I can have approach of the epoxide of the MCPBA of the peroxy acid from the top face, or I can have approach of that MCPBA from the bottom face, leading to the formation of the two different groups. Okay. Now that being said, we can also do this. and working on a six-membered ring kind of highlights it. We can take and react this with Br2 and water. This makes the hydrohalogen. So we would get the bromide on one and the hydroxyl group on the other. And it is an anti-addition in the way that that works. So that one, the way that that works is the bromine is attacked, leaving group, electrons swing back in, fill in the carbocation that develops. So you get the cyclic bromonium ion. In this case, I'm showing it as attacking from the top face. There's my cyclic bromonium ion. Your water molecule acts as your nucleophile and opens this in an SN2 reaction. And because that's SN2, you get backside attack and you get inversion of configuration. Once you invert it, your water came from the backside. And now we simply need to have a deprotonation. And so what I'll do is I'll just say minus H plus, that we have a base that pulls that proton. And we can make that molecule. Now, if we take this and we treat it with a base like sodium hydride, what we can make is the epoxide. We can close it up. So that reaction mechanism in the way that that functions is that is just a another SN2 reaction in a very tight molecule. So what happens here is we take the alcohol and deprotonate it. The H minus grabs it, returns the electrons to the oxygen, that makes my O minus. That's a good nucleophile. And that then turns around and does an SN2 reaction, which kicks out the bromide. And that makes the epoxide. So we can make epoxides that way as well. So it's not only using MCPBA in order to make an epoxide. There are also ways to take alcohols with adjacent leaving groups and be able to convert them into epoxides in certain cases. So that's a nice little trick as well. Let's think about this. Those halo,
Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
I had a quick little question on this. So for the Br2 H2O, what is preventing the second bromine from coming in before the water? Is it just because there's much more water in the solution?
Yeah, it's concentration driven.
Okay.
Exactly. You said it. It's just that the water is in much higher concentration. There's another better way to do this, Keegan. So that I was going to show you the other way to do this. The other way to do this is not to use bromine and water, but to use hyperbromous acid. Hyperbromous acid does essentially the same job. What it does is it creates a very polar bromine, and this attacks the bromide, kicks out the hydroxyl group as a leaving group. The bromide turns back around, makes the cyclic bromonium, and now you have hydroxide that can come in and attack this. So now your hydroxide can come in and act as your nucleophile. And now you don't have that competition of the two bromides. and then you could do the sodium hydride trick. And you can convert it into the epoxide. So that's another way to go about doing it. So let me ask this then. What happens if we take a trans double bond and we treat it with one hyperbromous acid and two sodium hydroxide or sodium hydride? Let's say sodium hydride. What is the geometry of the epoxide that we form? So if we want to work that out, it's the same process. What we do is we look at the formation first of the cyclic bromonium. That cyclic bromonium, treat it like an epoxide. It had to come from the same face, which means that one of these groups is forward and one of the groups is back. So if I'm treating these guys here, just making it a little bit easier to see, and this is my cyclic bromonium ion, then when the hydroxide comes in and attacks this, and because this is equivalent, it doesn't matter which side I go for. Okay, so once I do that, now we can see the stereochemistry. Okay, so there's our stereochemistry that has happened. Now, when I deprotonate it, what's going to happen is I'm going to get the O minus. The O minus is going to do an SN2 reaction. And as it does the SN2 reaction, it's going to knock out the bromine. That's going to set my stereochemistry again. And it's going to go through an inversion of configuration on that right-hand side. So I form the epoxide. On the right-hand side, the hydrogen is forward. Methyl group is back. On the left-hand side, the hydrogen is forward, or excuse me, the methyl is forward and the hydrogen is back. And so the stereochemistry that I'm ending up with, that's what I want there. The stereochemistry that I'm ending up with is that one methyl is back and one methyl is forward. And I've ended up with the trans configuration. I'll draw it from this side just because it's a little bit easier to see. This methyl is back and that methyl is forward. I'll put the hydrogen here, I'll put the hydrogen there. So this is trans, which means that I went from trans to trans in my epoxide and it made no difference. Why did it make no difference? Because I'm doing SN2 reactions, I'm inverting, but look at what I'm doing. I'm doing one SN2. So there's my first one, and then I'm doing a second SN2. I'm inverting twice. And because it's a double inversion, an inversion at each center, it retains the stereochemistry that it started with, which is kind of cool to think about. So these things aren't out of reach. And what I think I want to model and say here is that I don't expect anybody to memorize this. What I expect is that you should be able to work this out by drawing it out logically and following the SN2 steps and following the stereochemistry of what we're actually seeing take place as we go through something like this. So don't try to memorize the way that these reactions go. Just understand that they're inherently SN2 processes and then just map it out until you get to the product. That's my expectation. Okay, I want to show you a really cool reaction here, and I don't have the full model that I want to have for it, and it's been a long time since I've introduced it to a class. But I think that some of these reactions are really good to look at. This is an enantioselective epoxidation. So this says something about this class too that I'll tell you for a second, and that is that sometimes I select material that I want to do based on what I think the class can handle and where I think the class is at and how well we're progressing and the types of questions and things that I get. And so the fact that I'm giving you this reaction says a lot in how well you guys are doing and how much I'm trusting you guys in that you guys are just doing a really good job. So we have looked at regioselective. We've looked at stereoselective. Now we're looking at enantioselective. So in regioselective, you know, you're looking at where something is going to add, whether it's going to add here or here, the region in which it's adding. In stereoselective, you're looking at most of the time whether you're making a cis or trans double bond, or or we're looking at syn versus anti, that's what I want to hit. Now, when we're looking at enantioselective, now we're looking at R versus S and saying that we can actually select for an R enantiomer over an S enantiomer. And we've never tried to do that before. And the reason that you generally can't do that, well, maybe this takes a second just to make this really clear too. Let's do this. Let's just give a couple of examples of something that is regioselective. That if I take this and I treat it with H2SO4 and water, that this is a hydration. And the two possible things that I get are this guy and this guy. And this one is major. And the reason that we know that that's major is because when we look at the reaction, that we know that this goes through a carbocation before it goes through the hydration, and that the carbocation, which is a secondary carbocation before it goes down into the alcohol, is of much lower energy than if I go to a primary carbocation and then to the alcohol. And so it is this activation energy here that is helping me to determine that. And we're gauging that based on Hammond postulate and the transition state energy that is associated with the intermediate and the high energy intermediate, okay? And so the reason that I can get selectivity for one of these over the other is because one is of lower energy than the other in terms of its activation energy barrier. Is that clear? Okay, and then stereoselective, anti versus syn, or even if I look at making diastereomers in something which is stereoselective, the same thing happens. I can get differences in energy. What we typically don't see in R versus S is that the R isomer and the S isomer have exactly the same energies because they're mirror images. There's nothing different about them. And because they're mirror images, they have the same exact activation energy and they don't have different energy diagrams. So the question is, well, how do I get selectivity for one over the other if I can't get differences in energy diagrams? And the answer is you can't. What we need to do is create a difference in energy diagrams. We need to create a situation where the R and the S are of different energies. How do we do that? This is called a sharpless epoxidation. This is for Barry Sharpless at Scripps Institute. And sharpless epoxidation allows us to be able to take something that is prochiral. So it's not chiral yet because it's just got a double bond on it. And if we take and we just treat this with MCPBA, then what winds up happening is we get epoxidation from both faces. In getting both faces, we get enantiomers. And it's mirror image. So this is racemic. And again, it's because if we take a look at these and we assign R versus S, which we can do, and I don't, it takes a minute to do, I don't know if I really want to do it. That would be number one. I believe this would be number four. This is a carbon with two other carbons on it. This one has a hydrogen. So this is going to be number two, and that's going to be number three. Number four is back. So it's reading this way, which means that it's going this way, which means that that is an R stereocenter. And if I look at the other side is one. This is going to be my four. Coming down, this will still be two. And this will still be three. And so my four is forward. So I'm sweeping one, two, three. I'm sweeping clockwise, but it's going to have to go counterclockwise. So it's going to go one, two, and three, and it will go that way, which means that this one is an S. So that's an RS. And if I do the other one is going to be an SR. They are enantiomers in their configurations.
Could you briefly go over how you did the numbering? I got a little lost there.
I went fast on the numbering. epoxides are hard to number. I wasn't going to focus on the numbering, but sure. It's the Conningle Prelog rules that we're using. And so if we're numbering and I'm doing this center right here now, I need to look at all the substituents, which means I need to look at the oxygen. I need to look at this carbon. Maybe I need to do it this way. The substituents that I need to focus on are the oxygen, the carbon here, and the carbon there. Those are the four different substituents which are attached to the starred center. Conningle-Prelog rules say that we go by the highest atomic number, essentially the highest mass. Oxygen is bigger than carbon. So oxygen gets number one. Then I take a look at each one of these, and each one of these is a carbon that has different things attached to it. So I highlight the fact that it is a carbon. The methyl has three hydrogens. The carbon, which is down here, has a hydrogen and two other carbons. And the carbon which is on this side is attached to this carbon, and that carbon, and it has no hydrogen attached to it. So it is attached to three other carbons. So when I prioritize these out, I gave oxygen number one, but now number two is going to go to the carbon that is saturated with carbons, because this is essentially the highest atomic mass or the highest atomic number. I look at the first point of difference. So what I do is I say, all right, this guy has a carbon, this guy has a carbon, this guy doesn't have any, so he's out last. A second carbon, equivalent still, a third carbon and a hydrogen. Ah, that was the kicker, this one wins. I used to say the trump card, but I can't say that anymore. Just doesn't sound right anymore. So this guy has the highest priority. And between these two, the ones with the carbon has a higher priority than the hydrogens. And so this is going to be priority three and priority four. And then I always put the lowest priority in the back. And then I look to see how the other groups orient. And so then I could take that, since the lowest group is back, I can take these at face value where they are, and they are one, three, and two. And so I am sweeping in this way, which is a clockwise orientation, which is an R orientation. And yeah, when I do it in a cluster like this, it's much more complicated. I recommend drawing it out and doing each stereo center individually and doing it that way would be my recommendation, particularly with epoxides like that. Okay, so there is equal approach of the MCPBA from the top face and from the bottom face, because this thing is flat. And so there's no spherical difference from the top face versus the bottom face. So how do I get selectivity? Well, here's the sharpless epoxidation. This is the way the sharpless works. Sharpless works on using an alcohol to help coordinate things. And it uses tertiary butyl peroxide. It uses a titanium tetraisopropoxide. So there's four of those groups. And then it uses a chiral auxiliary, either plus or minus DEET. And I'll have to show you what the DEET actually is. And it is the DEET that makes a difference. That guy. What we find is that in this case, the epoxide is formed on the top face. And so the way that I could draw it is I could draw it this way to say that the epoxide formed from the top. And if I do all the same conditions, but I use minus DEET, then what happens is the epoxide forms from the bottom. And so that one would be that guy. So what is this plus DEET and what is this minus DEET? DEET is related to a very well-known chiral auxiliary. This is tartaric acid. It is a byproduct of winemaking. It's a natural product that can be isolated 100% pure. And if we take it and we react it and we make it into an ester, and so we react it with ETOH and PTSA and toluene, we can esterify this. And in the esterification reaction, we make what is called DEET, or what they abbreviate as DEET. It retains the stereocenters, but makes it into an ester. And this one is the plus DEET. Diethyl tartrate is what it is. And the minus DEET is the enantiomer of this. Both can be readily obtained in 100% purity. And what the DEET does is the DEET coordinates to the titanium and creates a chiral pocket, essentially, because there are stereocenters that are already here that are set. These stereocenters, when you make one epoxide versus the other epoxide, because the DEET is involved in this and already has two stereocenters, these two stereocenters plus these two that are created, and these two plus these two make diastereomers. And diastereomers are different molecules with different dipole moments. And because of that, they have different energy levels. Was this just discovered through trial and error? No, it was actually attempted, more or less, that they knew what they were trying to do. They knew that if you look at the isopropoxide, what's happening is titanium, the titanium catalyst, I don't know if I have it all here. I don't. So this will be a bit of work on my end. Titanium with the isopropoxides. Looks like this. It's coordinated by those groups. And this is in a 4+ state. And when you add the DEET to it, plus or minus, what it does is it coordinates with the two hydroxyl groups. And then you have the esters that come off of this. But these esters, if we are in the plus DEET, one of these is going up and one of these is going back. And on the other side of the molecule, it does the same. And what it does is it creates that chiral pocket. And then this guy coordinates to the very big, sterically bulky peroxide. And this side coordinates to the double bond that is the alkene. And it then adds, creating a chiral pocket. It will only add from one face. It'll bring them together from one face. It makes diastereomeric transition states, essentially, is what it does. And and one is lower energy than the other by a substantial amount, such that it just adds from one face, which is really kind of cool. And so the way that we remember is we do it this way. If we take, this is called a homoallylic alcohol. So it's not an allylic alcohol, it's a homoallylic alcohol. If we take the A, B, and C, and we orient this with the hydroxyl group up, and on the right, then when we do the two reactions with plus D, it will come from the top face. And with the minus D, it'll come from the bottom face. And so it's a model not to memorize, but to just basically have in your notes and have in your back pocket. And this is B and C, and it gives 99% enantiomeric excess, which is pretty spectacular. And the other one gives 99% the other direction. So why is this a value? Why is this important? Well, most of the medications that we make these days have stereocenters in them. And FDA law says that you cannot sell them as a racemate unless you can prove that the racemate is not harmful, which means that we need to sell them as single enantiomers. And thereby, we need to manufacture them as single enantiomers. Now, you can manufacture them racemic, and then you can use some chiral method or resolution in order to separate them, but you have to throw 50% of everything that you just made away. So you're throwing 50% of your profits away, or 50% of your cost that you went into manufacturing that drug. But if you can take and you can manufacture an epoxide and get 99% EE, and then you can open this up to make other functional groups doing SN2 reactions or other things that we've looked at using epoxides for, and you can do it such that you get 99% enantiomeric excess, that means that you're keeping almost 100% of everything that you made and that you're making it single-handed, and you can choose which hand you make. That's pretty astounding. That's pretty amazing. And so this is one of the routes one of the jobs of organic chemistry right now is to find reactions that are both catalytic and can produce 99% enantiomeric excess in terms of being enantioselective. And you make reactions like that, and then you're making serious money. So that's the reaction that's really pretty cool. All right, so that gets my epoxides. Using the epoxides, this is just a quick review of how do we use epoxides. Epoxides are generally not the end goal of synthesis. Most molecules don't just have epoxides in them. But what we can do is we can take these and we can open them up under basic conditions. So we can create diols. That should have been an O minus first. And then that guy picks up a proton from the water to finish out. So we can get a syn addition. Excuse me, this is an anti-addition. Anti-addition of diols. We can use nucleophiles in general. So if we have an asymmetric epoxide where we have an R group and a primary center, then we can use some nucleophile and dilute acid. And the nucleophile will preferentially attack the less sterically hindered position. And that's an anti-addition. You can think of your nucleophiles. Nucleophile can equal hydroxide. It can equal a halogen. It can equal a Grignard. Or maybe an alkoxide, sodium OR. It can be any number of these things. Could be the alkynyl anions. It could even be a hydride, such as lithium aluminum hydride. That could open it up, that could be that nucleophile. JC, I'm sorry. Were you talking about an example with the sharpless epoxidation? Okay, I'll bring one in. Let's do. Let's do this. Let's do titanium. Okay, so in this case, what we do is we orient this guy up. When that guy is up in that way, this is the top face. Coming from the bottom would be here, the bottom face. DEET is going to be from top face only. And so what I'm going to create is I'm going to create a product that I will draw the five-membered ring system. And let me think about how I want to draw that clear enough. That is not exactly what I wanted to do. It's close, but I need a better way to draw it. Usually what I do when I draw these, let's just do it this way. The epoxide sits here, the alcohol there, the hydrogen there, and this face is coming up. And we get this in 99% enantiomeric excess. So what we're not getting is we're not getting the mirror image of that. if we wanted to get the mirror image of that, then we would do something else. And let's say that then we wanted to do something creative with this. Maybe what we wanted to do was this molecule, we could then take and we can react with TMSCL and triethylamine. And then we wanted to react it with some nucleophile. Maybe we want to bring in a methyl I'm on the secondary center. So let's do something that would be a good SN2 reagent. Let's do sodium SCH3 as an SN2 reagent. I don't want to do a Grignard or something because I'm reacting at a secondary center and I set it up to be a secondary center. The other one is tertiary, so it's not going to react at the tertiary center. So the S minus would come in and react at that center, opening this up. So what I'm going to get is I'm going to get the OH up, the OTMS, and the hydrogen is going to be up, and the sulfur and the CH3 group are going to be down. And then I'll remove the TMS, and I'm getting this only. I'm not getting plus minus. There is no plus minus. I'm getting 99% enantiomeric excess in this product. And if I were to draw that and to draw it in a flat sort of way, I would say that this is equal to, we do the five-membered ring system, hydroxyl group up, OTMS group back, back is my sulfur and my methyl, and forward is my hydrogen. And I'm controlling the stereochemistry. And the stereochemistry was controlled in the first reaction that set up that gave me this with no plus minus. And then I can do all the other reactions that I would normally do, but I have to be more careful of my stereocenters because my stereocenters are locked in. And I'm doing it enantioselectively. If my target was for the other one, if I wanted this down, then I would have used the minus D and I could have made it an enantiomer. Does that help, Tracy?
Sorry. Jason, I was going to ask if it was kind of just about how when the titanium coordinates the D, why does that make why does that opt for an enantioselective oxidation? Like, what about the coordination?
All right. So let's look at the DEET for a second. When I look at the DEET, let me take a second, just think first where I want to be, where I want to end today. I'm okay. All right. This is one. The hydrogen, which is back, is four. The carbonyl is going to be two, and this guy is going to be three. Hydrogen is back, so this is one, two, three. This is an R. The other one is going to be one, two, and three. The other one is an R, and this is an S and an S. So the DEET is RR, for the plus and the S's and the minus is SS. Okay. When I make the complex and I'm binding to these guys, when this goes to make the epoxide and it adds, it can add from either face, right? Okay, so let's say that as it adds from the faces, let's say that what I have drawn here is the R and the R. This one is R and R as well. And then this guy, as it adds from the top face, I'm just going to make it up, could be SR or it could be RS. Now, if I take the DEET and I say that those are from the DEET, so those are my stereocenters from DEET, let me style these stereocenters and say these stereocenters, I'll style in blue, are from the epoxide or the forming epoxide. That means that my epoxide would combine with this in a single molecule to make either SR or from the other side, if it came from the other side, would make R, 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 RS. What's the relationship of those two molecules that have those six stereocenters?
Diastereomers.
Yeah, they're diastereomers. And so diastereomers have different dipole moments. They're different molecules altogether. And so what's happening here, I don't want to do it in another page. I know what I can do. The magic. Add a page. So what happens is in the transition states for these, which is sort of a concerted reaction mechanism to make the epoxide, which I think is endothermic. You're making diastereomeric transition states. And so one is going to be higher than the other in terms of their energy. One is going to be the RRRRSR for its transition state. And the other one, the transition state is going to be RRRRRS. And one of them is going to be lower in energy than the other. And they're going to be diastereomeric transition states. Did you guys, first semester, you should have talked about this. In first semester, when you did the stereo chapter, where you first learned about R and S, at the end of that stereo chapter, there is a concept where they take a chiralamine, alpha methylbenzylamine. And they treat this with tartaric acid. And so this one is 1, 4, 2, 3. This is an R. And they use tartaric acid. And they use the plus tartaric acid to, let's say that this was racemic. So we had both of the amines. This is just a check-in to see if you guys remember doing this, or maybe you didn't do it. Maybe Zeruba didn't do it.
I don't remember ever learning this in lecture. This was, we wrote an abstract about this for our lab, but we never really, like, the lab wasn't really super interactive.
Okay. So the idea here was that tartaric acid makes a salt because it's an acid and these guys are bases. And so the tartaric acid, just as we just showed, this is an R and an R. And this one is the S. And you can make two different acids out of this. What it winds up doing is it winds up making the ammonium tartrate. So you make NH3 with a positive charge. This would be the S. And you make the tartrate that crystallizes with this. So this is one salt, and this is the SRR salt. And this is a complex between those. And the other salt that you make is the RRR salt. And because the tartaric acid is locked into its configuration, this is the SRR. These salts are diastereomers. And they have different solubilities. And one of these precipitates out as a solid, and one of them remains aqueous in solution. And you can resolve them. This is what's called a chiral resolution. Chiral resolution depends on creating different solubilities because you're creating diastereomers. We use that concept in this reaction with the titanium tetraisopropoxide by using the plus D to the minus D to create chiral transition states. And the chiral transition states then have different energies, and one will go forward faster than the other. Sweet. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't make that quite clear enough. And
that was awesome. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, no, that was a great question. I like that. And so sometimes in order to teach a new thing, you have to reach back to something to make it more familiar and tangible. And that's always appropriate. So yeah, great question. Okay. Last thing I wanted to show you, really, because we were doing the general epoxides, was to show you just this concept and idea that that from an epoxide, that we can react them with different sorts of nucleophiles, and we can make different types of substrates. And the type of nucleophile that we can use is really only limited by the substitution pattern of the epoxide and our imagination. So we can use cyanide, we can use alkoxides, you can use thiols, and they're all opening in much the same way. We can use grignards. We can use hydrides. And under certain circumstances, we can use alcohols and acid to open them in the opposite pattern. And so we have all these different things that we can do with the epoxides. And just all of them in these guys going for that position. These are all under basic conditions. If you notice that these are all anion, 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 anion. And it's not until I use an acid that I select for that position, but only under certain circumstances can I use an acid to be able to do that. I can really only do that with an alcohol, or the other one that I can do that with is RNH2, an amine, and do it under acidic conditions. And I can make amino alcohols. Where I can do that as well, which is kind of nice. So alcohols and amines are the two places where I can really do that with the epoxide. And so that really summarizes up all the different things that we can do with epoxides. And that really sort of finishes out that chapter in everything that I really wanted to do. Okay, so in the last couple of minutes, what I want to do is remind you of some locations of resources and some things that we've got. And so I'll give you a second to catch up writing. Looks like most people are caught up. So let me switch out of this share. And switch into a Canvas share. And so in sharing Canvas, what I want to do is just show you the modules just really quick. That in the alkenes, in putting this together in Canvas, I gave you all the notes for the alkene chapter and all the lectures. They're all linked in Canvas. And you have all of the reactions done out in a star chart in terms of what you can do with the alkenes. And the syn and anti-additions I've tried to label out as best I could. From there, each chapter I went through and I did that. So in the alkyne introduction, there's a similar star chart. And for the alkynes, what I did is I gave you the synthesis of an alkyne. How do we make the alkyne? And then what can we do with it? And all the different places that we can go with the alkynes. The lectures are all linked there. So I've been spending some time trying to get the Canvas shell up looking good. In the free radicals, the free radicals doesn't really have a star chart that we can do, but I picked out the important reactions. And to talk about what to look for, linked in the lectures. I did the same thing for the alcohols. So we've got both how to make the alcohols on the top, the different ways in which we can make alcohols, and then all the things that we can do with them, and including the different protecting groups and the different oxidizing agents. And I linked in the lectures. And the only reason I'm going through all of this to show you is because I know that I'm using two websites. I'm using my website and I'm using Canvas. And all my lectures have been on my website. And so I'm getting the feeling that many people are just going directly to my website and maybe not looking at Canvas as much. And I was backdating all of these. I was going back in and putting all these back in. Today's lecture will go in here once I'm done. And this gives us the ethers, the way to make ethers and the things that we can do with them and the ways to make epoxides and what we can do with them. I did. Oh, I put the sharpless on there. So the sharpless Nantia selective is in there as well. So all those things are there. And those star charts should be really helpful. And then what I did is on the exam page, which I made live, I get wordy, you guys know that. I give you a lot of information there. And then I put in this study guide that we've been talking about. And so this has the major concepts that need to be covered for this lecture. The regioselective selective reactions. I didn't put all the protecting groups in because this is an older sheet that I was working off of a little bit, but it's still got really good problems. This has all the pattern recognition of how do we do synthesis and synthons and how do we add one carbon, what that retro looks like for adding one carbon, how do we add two carbons and the different synthetic equivalents of the different synthons that you would get and where those synthons come from, the patterns, whether it's an aldehyde or the epoxide. So this is what I call a 1-2 versus a 2-1 pattern. There's three carbon patterns and what those patterns look like in terms of their retrosynthesis and whether it is an aldehyde, an epoxide, or a ketone that you're trying to react with. And really, after you go through the three carbon patterns, four carbon pattern is no different. Four carbon pattern is just the same as the three carbon pattern. It's just got a bigger R group that's on it. And so there's nothing there new to learn. And then I break it down into this, basically 1-2, where attachment is at 1 with the oxygen, or I've got an R group, which is also on the 1 carbon with the oxygen, or it's a 1-2 pattern where the oxygen is on 2 and I want to break it 1. So if I want to break at 1 and oxygen is on 2, that's an epoxide pattern. If I want to break at 1 and the oxygen is on 1, that's either an aldehyde or a ketone pattern. And then all those examples to try. And I've got lots of practice problems for each one of the patterns. So I give you the pattern, and then I give you the practice problems that use the pattern. So you've got lots of practice problems here, and it just keeps going. And then there's some other key ideas, some other things that you can do that are just neat things to think about that are in here, that are in the thing. And then what I did this morning is I used practice problems from previous lectures. I'm going to stop sharing that for a minute. I used practice problems from previous exams and went through a series of practice problems from previous exams this morning. And I think that we'll do that for one more day. Maybe we'll do that on Tuesday as well. And then I'll open up that exam after we've had what I think is sufficient practice. So I think I was thinking about opening it this weekend, but I think I want you guys to practice more this weekend, plus you have another quiz to do. So I want you to focus on that. And then we'll do one more day of practice type problems and give you chances to come into office hours and ask questions and deal with things. And then I think midweek next week, I'll open up that exam and leave it open through the weekend so that you guys can coordinate schedules a little bit and figure out how you wanna tackle that. Does that sound like a plan?
I have a question kind of related to the scheduling of the exam with a lab report coming up. Is the lab report kind of on like pause a little bit?
Yes. Okay. The lab report is on pause. Cool. I won't set a due date for that lab report, or I'll change or modify the due date to give you time to do it after the exam, because I want to put emphasis on the exam rather than the lab report that's due. Plus, I haven't got the videos done. So
awesome.
It's all going to work out.
Great. I appreciate that. It's like a little bit more balanced and helps me schedule my time better. So
good. Yeah. I'm reasonable. I'm willing to work with everybody. The schedule's got to make sense. And I don't want to slam you in two different places at the same time when I know that you also have other classes and other instructors who are doing the same. So yeah. Don't panic. It will all work out. Okay. All right, I think I've kind of shown you everything I wanted to do. I'm up against the clock at 2:00. And I think what I'll do is I'll end it here and I'll stay on the line. And if anybody has any questions, stay on with me. And other than that, I'll see everybody for the afternoon lab at 3:00. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.